Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to yet another episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai and host of the show. But isn't this your show as much as it is mine, if not for the wonderful questions we get from you week after week? This program just wouldn't even be. So in order of gratitude, you come second. You come second because the first gratitude always belongs to Swami. Offering our most loving and grateful pranams to Swami, let's begin this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. And a happy Navratri to all of you. Today is the 8th day of Navratri festival, a day where we worship goddess Mahagauri, one of the most benevolent forms of the 9 Devis. She removes all sufferings and grants all the wishes of the devotees. So greetings on this most auspicious day to all of you. May the blessings, love and grace of our Divine Mother Sai be with each one of you. That also explains why we are a bit delayed today. We had a program in Mandir and all our programs are delayed by, I think, 15 minutes. I should have started at 11. It's almost 11:17 now. But let's hope that we can catch up. Let's then head to the program of this week. We have not one but two questions this week, both from the same listener, but I'm not too sure, given that we've started late, if we'll be able to cover both of them today. So maybe I will spread it over 2 weeks, or maybe not. Let's see how it goes. But before we even get to the questions, we have one more ritual to get done with on our show, don't we? Yes, it's the quote of the week. The quote is going to be a very simple one from an author whose greatness was actually his simplicity. His words were simple, the stories he wrote were so simple, but that is what made them so endearing and relatable. I'm referring to the legendary Indian writer R.K. Narayan. And the words I wish to read out today are from the Ramayana that he has written. Maybe I will not tell you which part it is from. Let's do an explain with reference to context, an exercise we would have in our English exams in school. I will read out the few lines. Let's see if you can guess which part of the Ramayana these lines are about. I quote, "In a world where we are accustomed to rivalries over possessions, authority and borders, and people chasing over the issues, ours or mine, not yours, it is rather strange to find two people debating whose kingdom it is not, and asserting yours, not mine." End of quote. That must have been quite simple if you thought that that must be about the dialogue between Rama and Bharata in the forest, where each was saying the other must rule. Well, you got it right then. Many times when we read the Ramayana, especially if we already know it, we just breeze through the story. And I would always think that how would it be if I were to read the story as though I just don't know the plot at all? Maybe one of the parts that would really surprise me would be this one, where there is this raging, almost sort of an overdramatic debate between Rama and Bharata, where two brothers are fighting for the throne, not saying it is my throne, but saying it is yours and I have nothing to do with it. In the case of Rama and Bharata, it's almost like the Lord and the devotee, isn't it? Bharata literally looks up to Rama as his God, and there was no way he could take Rama's place. Forget if the people will accept him in Rama's place or not, he himself could not accept the idea of him taking Rama's place. Why is it that this debate looks strange to us? Why is it that even within brothers and siblings, it is more common to find an argument where each one claims his or her right over property? It's a simple question of priority. It's not that wealth or wanting wealth is wrong. We all need property and even certain amount of power and authority. But when we give more priority to property over propriety, that's when the problem really starts. Of course, in the case of Rama and Bharata, as I said, there was this intense devotion which made the difference. But even if we were to remove that aspect and look at this argument, it is a debate of propriety. Bharata tells Rama that you are the eldest and so you have to rule. Rama says you have to rule because that was father's last wish. And finally, Bharata accepts only because he loses in this argument of whose dharma it is to rule at this point. It is certainly not wrong to pursue wealth, comforts, property and power. These are all different forms of security. We believe that if we have this for me and my family, I can be secure. And in fact, a happy family around us is also a form of security we seek for ourselves. And all these different forms of security are referred to as artha. The only thing we have to keep in mind is Dharma should always precede Artha. I want something, but at no point I will want it so much that it becomes more important than Dharma or propriety. And generally, the noble people, like Bharata in this case, prefer to err on the side of selflessness rather than on the side of selfishness. And the reason we are told such stories again and again is that this would be the ideal for us. We must not be following this, we may not be following this right now, but we will at least know that this is the yardstick to measure ourselves. And this is what we must strive to be. So dear listeners, before we move on, let me read those simple yet profound words of R.K. Narayan one more time. In a world where we are accustomed to rivalries over possession, authority and borders, and people clashing over issues, ours or mine, not yours, it is rather strange that to find two people debating whose kingdom is not and asserting yours, not mine. So let's head to the question for this week. The question, as I said, there are two questions, and the listener who has asked us this question is a very regular listener, and she very regularly writes feedback to us. So it's a pleasure to have a question from her. And what makes me more happy is she's recorded it in her own voice and sent it to us. So let's listen to the two questions. As I said, we'll just see how it goes, because I feel these questions come from very important concepts. So if we could spend a little more time on speaking about them, I think we would benefit more. So let's see if we can handle both questions, or we can handle one question today and the next one the next week. But we'll listen to both the questions nevertheless.
Sai Ram, Brother Prem. I am Saraswati from Chennai. Firstly, I take this opportunity to congratulate you on successfully completing 1 year of answering booth. May Swami bless you. I have two questions. Question number one. I am very particular about keeping my house clean, which involves some acts wherein I have to chase away lizards, use some insect repellents in the cupboards, whereby cockroaches, ants and other insects get killed. Does my act amount to sin or non-violence? I do not know any other means to keep my house, which is Swami's gift, clean and tidy. I have heard about many experiences where Swami is very particular about cleanliness. What is my dharma as a homemaker to keep my house clean? Question number two. I am a very soft-spoken person, usually do not interfere in others' issues. Swami's Chinnakatha about Ramakrishna Paramahansa correcting his disciples Brahmananda and Vivekananda for being too meek and being too rude respectively set me thinking. Also the fact that the world is not suffering because of adharmic people, but good people not voicing or reacting for the acts done by adharmic people. I have also heard of some instances where Swami says, do not try to correct the world, rather try to transform yourself first. As a Swami's devotee, what is my role? I am unable to correct my own family members at times. I am not in a position to tell them that they are wrong. I am confused as to how far I can remain silent and when is it warranted to point out their mistakes. Sai Ram, thank you.
Thank you, Sister Saraswati, for those two questions. Thank you very much for your kind wishes. The two questions appear to be quite different, but actually in a very subtle way, in a very spiritual way, they are connected. The answer to both of them actually arise from a certain way of thinking, but probably we'll come to that later. We will start with the first question. I think it's an interesting question, a question that may be in the minds of many, especially homemakers like her and even others, I mean all of us, to have to indulge in activities of cleanliness, which probably involves a little bit of violence in that sense. So the question was a very interesting one. What about the pests that we end up killing? To answer that question, probably I should make a reference to a conversation that happened between Dr. John Hislop and Swami. It's recorded as one of the conversations in his book, Conversations with Baba. And he asks this very same question. He says a homemaker has to deal with pests in managing the household, but that also involves a little bit of violence. Is that all right? And Swami's reply in one sentence very crisply is that it is right, they have to be dealt with. That's what Swami said. Swami said there's nothing wrong in keeping the house free from pests. But of course Swami says that as long as it is only for this purpose, there's nothing wrong in dealing with pests. So that's from the conversations with Baba. The question was asked by John Hislop. To be honest, the answer to the first question actually ends there, right? You know, is it all right? Swami says it is all right. So that's where the answer really ends, because Swami always has the final word, at least for us. That's how it should be, right? So Swami has said it's okay. But probably I'll speak a little more, because, you know, if this question has arisen in our minds, is it right or wrong to kill? I think it's a question that has come from within. And why does this question come? And if Swami is very clear about that, why do we even have this doubt? I feel there's a little bit of, we need to go a little more into that, because the thought arises from the idea that I should not harm anybody, right? The act, the feeling of non-violence or ahimsa. And ahimsa is a very fundamental quality for a spiritual aspirant. In fact, even for a regular dharmic life, one of the qualities which Patanjali speaks about, you know, Swami has spoken at length about this yama, niyama, the first two limbs of the Ashtanga Yoga, where yama are the disciplines that one has to follow as an individual, in that satya and ahimsa, the first two, it's five-pronged. The yama is five-pronged, and Swami says that satya, ahimsa, aparigraha, brahmacharya, and non-violence is one of, ahimsa is one of them. I mean, the other one I'm not able to recollect right now. But ahimsa is one of them. So it's a fundamental quality, and I think this question itself arises from that. That we know that it is wrong to harm another being. But here we are having to do that. But now when we listen to what Swami has to say about it, Swami says it is all right. So does that mean is it okay to indulge in violence in dealing with pests? And when we say pests, how do we define that? He said, yes, those insects and other smaller beings which come into our house. Or does that mean anybody or any person who also becomes like a pest? Is it all right to deal with them in a rude manner, in a violent manner? So that becomes a question, because when we take any word of the Master, especially when Swami says something, yes, we have to accept it. Like, as I said, this is the final word because Swami has said so. Yes, we have to accept it with faith. But this question has also come. This question that it is not right to harm any being, I am harming it. So it is not wrong to raise this question, but at the same time, you have to raise this question holding on to Swami's words as the ultimate. And when we do this, is when we actually understand those words of Swami, when Swami says it's all right to deal with pests in this manner, in a little more deeper sense, and we will be able to apply what Swami is saying in other contexts without diluting Swami's message and without distorting Swami's message to suit our convenience. You know, that is something which is very, very important. In fact, in one of Swami's discourses, Swami makes this point while referring to the Bhagavad Gita. Swami said that Bhagavad Gita is like a stream of wisdom which flows through two banks. And I think this was something which Swami said during one of his 1990 Samukos discourses, which we happened to study on the other program, where Swami said there are two banks through which this wisdom of the Bhagavad Gita flows. And one is the statement that Shraddhavan Labhate Jnanam, which means the one with faith acquires wisdom. And the other bank, Swami said, is Samshayatma Vinashyati. The one who has doubts, who is filled with doubts, perishes. Right? So Swami said that if you want to understand the wisdom of Gita, for that matter, the wisdom in the words of the Master, the wisdom for the words in the scriptures, you will have to dive into this stream which is between these two banks. One is not going to the point of doubt, and the other is not completely blindly accepting whatever is said in those works or what the master says, not taking it literally. Because both of this can cause confusion. When you very, very blindly accept whatever Swami says, I think that is going to lead to fanaticism in a certain level. And if you completely doubt, which is like Swami says, the other end of the bank, you'll never be able to dip into this water and draw the wisdom out. So if you want to really draw the wisdom out of any of the words of profundity by the master, by the scriptures, you will have to be between these things where you hold on to the word saying that I have faith in this because this has been said by Swami. Swami says so, it must be true, so I hold on to it. But this question has arisen in me, so I will question this, I will raise this question within myself and I'll try to understand what these words mean. So I should be able to answer these questions which arise in my mind. I should be able to settle this doubt and confusion which arises in my mind and also be able to accept Swami's words. And when we do that process, I think it is only then that we actually understand the essence of what Swami really says. So in this case, Swami says it is all right to deal with, the pests which come and trouble our peace and at home. But at the same time, this question of is it wrong or is it not wrong to indulge in such kind of violence has to be answered. So let's maybe talk a little bit about why this doubt arises at all. And I think it'll explain a little about the idea of karma itself, because we're talking about when we say that will this lead to sin, will this lead to consequence, we are talking about the concept of karma, right? Now, we can always avoid actions that harm other beings. But what about actions which we cannot avoid? In the case like cleaning your house, you cannot avoid that, right? When we ask this question, is it okay to kill pests, you know, that come into our homes? It's always a question about what I refer to as, you know, you have a certain space that you occupy, and if someone else infringes into that space, we are essentially saying that it is all right to evict that being or that entity which is trying to encroach into our space and we can live. Well, that's actually a very dangerous statement to say, because all of your conflicts and the national level and international level conflicts actually comes from that. So it is necessary to look at it specifically from the point of view of we humans clearing out pests from our house. Well, one of the things is, you know, when you're talking about competing for space, if we look around, if we look at ourselves as a human race, wherever we have set up our inhabitation, it has resulted in the loss of inhabitation, loss of habitat for many, many beings, be it birds and animals and for that matter insects and other small reptiles too. In fact, if you look at any of the cities from which we all come from, be it the metros like Bangalore or Chennai or Mumbai, these are all cities where most of us live in what we call suburbs. And these suburbs were actually grasslands and marshy lands even in our own lifetimes. You know, when we were children, we would have seen them as absolutely barren and, you know, maybe forest lands, which have now become places where we have built our homes and, you know, buildings, and we are living there. So literally, even in our own lifetime, we have seen this happening of we snatching away the habitat of certain animals and we're living there. In fact, even if you look at Parthi, we have seen that happen in our very lifetime. In fact, in the past 10 years, we've seen it. If you had come to Parthi probably in the 80s or even early 90s, you will know that from Swami's parents' samadhi behind, there used to be fields. There were no buildings there. Now you see that the buildings go right up to, you know, Chitravati, end of Chitravati. So literally we have snatched the habitat of so many of these beings and we are living in those areas. Well, that is about living space. And if you talk about any other activity that we are involved for that matter, the agricultural activity that we do, no other human activity has caused the loss of habitat as much as our agricultural activities has caused. I think this is the statistics prove this point. So many times we ask this question of, we have this feeling that I'm a vegetarian, so I don't harm any other beings. We don't do it directly, but we certainly do it in some extent. In the same way about clothes. In fact, I think a few years back we had this question from one of our listeners that Swami distributes silk saris, and silk is got by killing silkworms. Isn't it a form of violence? And one of our team members actually wrote a beautiful reply. He said that, all right, you say that silk is got by causing harm to other beings. Well, if you talk of any other synthetic fabric that we use for clothing these days, most of it comes from different forms of refinement and different forms of petroleum products being used. A lot of these synthetic material come from there. And they actually lead to a pollution of a lot of water bodies, leading to the death of some of these aquatic habitats. So in that sense, whatever we do, we might be wearing even cotton clothes. Even cotton is considered to be a crop which uses a lot of resources compared to any other plant. So in that sense, every human activity that we do, the living space that we are in, the kind of clothes that we wear, the kind of food that we eat, the kind of activities that we do, all of this results in some form of harm to some being or the other. So when Swami says it is all right to deal with pests like this, I think one of the things which Swami might be hinting at is that don't worry, even otherwise you're going to be doing a lot of harm. It is not like you not doing this is going to make you squeaky clean of being absolutely non-violent. I think that was one of the reasons why Swami might be saying that. So in that sense, you can be a vegetarian, you can be a vegan, you can say that I don't use fur and leather, and I don't kill the ants and bugs and all these things which are at home. The fact is, you still will cause harm in some way or the other. I think that is a point that we need to acknowledge. So that leads us to the question of, so we are harming beings in some form or the other. So there can only be two ways of doing it. One is what we consciously do and what happens unconsciously. When we talk about dealing with pests at home, it's about consciously harming some of those beings right in front of us. I think this actually needs a little more analysis of the idea of karma itself. When we consciously do karma, when we unconsciously do karma, what is the difference between that and how are we supposed to do karma? Once we know that what we are doing is wrong, if we stop, is it necessary? I mean, it's a complete debate altogether. And as I said, I think I will not be able to go into that this week. Probably we'll start next week's discussion with this, leading on to answering the question, the second part of the question that Sister Saraswati has asked us. So it leads to two things, the mistakes that we do consciously, then the mistakes that we do unconsciously. So what we consciously do, the actions that we do which consciously harm others, we can as much as possible reduce. And the different ways what we talk of becoming vegetarian, some people feel that they should become vegan, and some people feel that they should not use leather and all of that. I think that's fine. If that is the choice that you want to make and that is the way you want to reduce your footprint on earth, I think it's very, very good. In fact, there's a beautiful statement which I always quote, which I feel is very, very profound. It says, walk softly upon earth. I think that is a way by which we'll have to all learn to live. As we know that, we look at earth and we call it Mother Earth. It is a form of mother and we are literally walking on it. The moment you know that this is mother and this is something which is worthy of reverence, you cannot stop walking on it, right? There is no way that you and I can stop walking or stop using the earth that we are living on. But the moment you know that, that reverence will cause you to be a little more cautious, a little more careful and a little more reverential in the way that you use the resources on earth. I think that's the meaning of that statement, walk softly upon earth. So for the conscious errors that we do, conscious harm that we cause to the other creation creatures, with a pragmatic approach, with a practical approach, as much as possible, reduce our footprint. I think that is where what Swami speaks about as the ceiling on desires, or for that matter, in general, moderation in life. All of this helps in this, that yes, we are using the resources that are around us and the process of using these resources cause harms to other creatures. So I'm aware of that. So when you say you're aware of that, I think one important thing is it automatically gives you a certain amount of humility. Because many times when you look at people who follow some of these practices of being vegetarian or being vegan for that matter, there is a certain amount of pride in the choice that they've made. They have this feeling that I do not hurt other beings. The moment you know that the mere existence of you on the face of earth is actually causing harm to other beings, when that idea comes, when that consciousness comes, you'll automatically be humble. That just because you being a vegetarian does not mean that you don't harm any beings at all. Yes, consciously you're pulling yourself back, but it'll also give you a bit of humility that just existing, you are causing enough harm and you're just probably pulling back a few steps instead of going full throttle. That's all it is. So that humility will come. And the second thing is, you will be a little more moderate in your use. You will use as much as you need. As Swami would say, a moderation of everything, moderation of energy, the moderation of water, moderation of the other resources, and the moderation of even space. In fact, it's beautiful that we're talking about this during Navratri celebrations, because one thing that Swami would often repeat during the Navratri discourses, the Dashana discourses, is one of the best ways to celebrate this festival is to celebrate it by making proper utilization of elements, because all of these elements are represented as Mother Nature, the Mother Goddess. So we are worshipping Mother Goddess. So if we optimally use all our resources, that itself is a form of worshipping Mother Goddess. So this idea that I should consciously leave a lesser footprint on earth will itself lead to a little bit of moderation and what Swami refers to as ceiling on desires. And this idea that anyway I am harming beings, even when you are being a vegetarian, vegan, you're not using any of these other products which come from animals and other beings directly, will still give you a little bit of humility. You will not be so arrogant about what we are. We all are vegetarians because thanks to Swami we are vegetarians. I mean, otherwise would we have so much love and compassion? I mean, I can speak for myself. I don't think I would have. So a little bit of humility will come automatically even though we follow some of these practices. Now that leaves us with, what about the unconscious harm that happens because of us? Especially when we live in a society, as I said, there is a lot of unconscious harm that we do to things around us. Especially it is said that if there is a householder couple, there is no way that you can have a home, you can run a home with children and taking care of your parents without causing harm like this. In fact, it is said in Manusmriti that when a person chooses to become a householder, when a couple decide to run a home, they are willfully taking upon the dangers of performing such karmas. This is what the Manusmriti says, that when a couple choose to set up a home, they know that this is the danger of setting up a home. You cannot live like a monk who, you know, there are some of these monks who eat only what has already fallen from the tree, who eat only after the other birds and, insects have had their fill of the fruit or whatever is there, or they eat only that which is not eaten by anybody else. The moment you say that I want to set up a home, I want to have children, I want to take care of them, you cannot involve in such a lifestyle where you don't do any harm to any being. So you're willfully getting into a life where you're taking upon the dangers of performing such karmas. But when a householder or when a family sets up a house like this, this again the Manusmriti says, that there are a lot of other benefits that people around derive from a family. The other beings, even the other beings, the other smaller insects and animals and birds, derive a lot of benefit from a household. So, in a sense, Manusmriti says that the unconscious errors that you do gets nullified by the unconscious benefit that you bring when you set up a home. And in fact, it is said that all the other, the three other varnas, you know, we talk about brahmacharya, grihastha, and the vanaprastha and the sannyasa. The Manusmriti says that three other varnas actually derive benefit from this phase of being a householder, this phase of having a house. So in that sense, they all should respect this position, because here is a person who is willfully taking these karmas upon himself or herself and giving them the benefit of probably deriving nourishment, or, you know, a sannyasi for that matter, he can concentrate on his sadhana, he can concentrate on his study of the Vedas without worrying about the food, because the householder is going to provide him with the food. I mean, I'm talking about the ancient structure as it was. So in that sense, the Manusmriti says that the unconscious errors that you do when you run a household gets nullified by the unconscious good that you end up doing. And the Manusmriti goes a little more into detail about this, and it speaks of a very interesting topic about the 5 slaughterhouses that exist in each household where creatures get killed unconsciously. And it speaks of 5 yajnas that each person who lives in a household, the husband and wife, have to do in order to balance the effects of these sins that are performed in these 5 slaughterhouses. I will not go into what the Manusmriti says, because the same concept has been spoken of by Swami too, and I think in a way Swami has given it to us in a form that is more applicable to us, which is more applicable to the present age. Because if you talk about the 5 slaughterhouses which Manusmriti speaks about, it's not completely applicable to many of the households, the modern households today. So in a way, Swami literally modifies that and gives it to us in a very beautiful form. And I would like to talk about that. So Swami also speaks about the 5 offenses or the 5 doshas that husband and wife, or for that matter, anybody, does not necessarily mean a person who is married and who is having a family. I think all of us, in that sense, we are living in the society, we are having a house, we are performing actions, which is very similar to probably what a householder performs. So in that sense, this is applicable to everybody. Anybody who has a household, who is living in the society, who is living in a community, is doing these 5 types of offenses or 5 doshas. So what are these 5 doshas? Swami says, number 1, when we speak, when we communicate, some of the germs get killed. In fact, I think this can be even extended, because nowadays there is this talk about the number of birds and animals that are getting affected because of we speaking over telephones, because of our use of mobile technology is causing the harm to some of the birds and animals. So when Swami says when we speak, some germs get killed, I think we can extend it to the idea that the amount of harm that our process of communication causes to other beings and animals and insects and germs. So the first dosha Swami speaks about is the harm that is caused when we speak. The second is when we walk or when we commute, we cause the death of so many beings. When, how many times when we drive past a highway, we find so many animals, we find some frogs, we find some cats being run over. Sometimes it's inevitable, and Swami speaks about the number of beings that get killed even when we walk. Maybe ants, and for that matter even some creatures which are invisible to our eyes. So Swami says the second dosha, the second offense that we do is when we walk, when we commute, when we go from a place to the other, the death that we cause. The third is when we sweep. That's what Swami says, but I think we can extend this to mean that the process of maintaining cleanliness around us. When Swami says sweep, when you clean, I think this also refers to the question which was asked today, because it was all about maintaining cleanliness, right? So Swami says the act of maintaining cleanliness around us through sweeping or mopping or whatever it is, also causes harm to other creatures. The fourth one which Swami speaks about is the various activities for which we use fire. The activities of cooking, to keep ourselves warm, or for all the other activities which we use fire. And every time we use fire, we are causing death of certain creatures very unconsciously. The fifth one is when we use water. So Swami says even in the process of using water for the various activities, for our bath, for our cleaning our places, even that involves the killing of certain beings. So these are the 5 doshas that Swami speaks about. When we speak, when we commute, when we keep our surroundings clean, when we use fire, and when we use water. And as you can see, none of these can actually be avoided. These are things that we all have to perform every day. And if we don't perform that, I think if we don't use water, we're going to be causing more discomfort for the people around us. So there is no way we can avoid these 5 doshas. There is no way we can avoid speaking. There is no way we can avoid keeping our surroundings clean. So these are five doshas which are inevitable for a person living in the society. So Swami says that though these are done unconsciously, though these harms and violence is performed unconsciously, to a certain extent, they will manifest as consequences to us. They will come back to us. So Swami says, the remedy for this is that we have to perform five yajnas. And the five yajnas are Deva Yajna, Pitru Yajna, Daiva Yajna, it is not Deva, it is Daiva Yajna, Bhuta Yajna, and Atithi Yajna. So these are the five yajnas a person living in the society has to perform. And don't worry, it's not as scary as the name sounds. It's not like each one of us have to do Veda Purusha Saptaha Jnana Yajna as it's happening in Parthi. It's not that kind of a yajna. In fact, Swami very beautifully explains to us what each of these yajna actually stand for. Talking about Deva Yajna, the first one, Swami says that this is performed to atone for the sins that we perform through the act of communication. One of the things is when we speak, as Swami was explaining, that we kill germs through our process of speaking. Apart from that, we speak a lot of words which probably might hurt people. Right? In everyday communication, we don't mean to hurt them. We say something which hurts somebody. Or, you know, we might be making a reference to some other person. Somebody might be taking it to heart. I wonder, speaking on the radio, how many people have hurt like that? I really don't know. So when you communicate with people, you have a certain meaning for the words that you speak, but somebody else might take a completely different meaning for the word that you speak. But Swami says that even that adds to a little bit of unconscious error on your part. So Swami says the way to deal with that, or the way to remedy for that, is by performing what he calls the Deva Yajna. And this is nothing but, it's not about doing a yajna. Swami says that doing bhajans, doing Nagar Sankirtan, chanting Vedas, chanting mantras and stotras, and reading out scriptures aloud, singing devotional songs, Swami says all of this comes under the category of Deva Yajna. You atone for the mistakes that you do when you unconsciously speak, when you unconsciously hurt others with your words. And if you look at it, all of this comes under the category of things which we perform as a spiritual activity, but even others around us benefit. And Swami would often say this, when you participate in bhajans, it becomes a community singing. You also help the people around you. When you perform Nagar Sankirtan, you also help the others to enjoy those vibrations. So is the case with the Vedas and Slotras and Mantras. So Swami says, this Deva Yajna which you perform by taking the name of the Lord aloud, not only you benefit yourself, but unconsciously you are also benefiting others. So this is one Yajna which Swami speaks about. The second one is Pitru Yajna, the worship that we offer to our forefathers actually. Pitrus are very commonly referred to in the scriptures as forefathers. I think they call them the mains, right? The people who have moved on from the physical existence, and the tarpanam which you do, or the rituals that you do for people who have passed on, comes as Pitru Yajna. If this is part of your religious, or this is part of your rituals, I think you most certainly can do them. But what about those who don't have this as part of their ritualistic traditions? Swami dilutes this even more and makes it more applicable to us. Swami says, Pitru Yajna, forget about serving people who have moved on. Forget about performing rituals for ancestors who have passed on. Yes, it is part of the tradition, but Swami says that this Pitru Yajna is taking good care of parents and elders and grandparents even when they're alive. Through your actions, pleasing them through your actions, pleasing them through your obedience. Swami says this itself is a form of Pitru Yajna. Right? This itself is a great service. In fact, I could probably go into this. I mean, there is a amazing economic study of how in a family, when the children take care of their parents when they grow old, when the old in the society are taken care of by these small sustainable units called families, what a great benefit it results in the macroeconomics. That's a study by itself. Because once you take care of these small, I mean, when people become old, when people become senile, when they are no more contributors, economic contributors, contribute in a more tangible manner to society, they literally become a certain amount of liability for society. Of course, they never are. That's what Swami says. The advice and the wisdom that they can give us is invaluable, but even from the economic point of view, they become liabilities. But when the family takes care of the caring for them, takes care of taking care of them till their time, I mean, there are studies which show that this helps the nation's economy in a great way, rather than allowing the government to take care of them in the form of pensions and doles. If the children themselves take care of their parents, that's why Swami says that when you do this simple act, which is actually a part of our dharma, I mean, this is not a yajna that we're doing. Taking care of parents is part of our duty. So Swami says, when this performance of one's duty of taking care of one's elders in the family is done, you are unconsciously doing some amount of benefit to people around you. That's what Swami says. So the second one which Swami speaks of is the Pitru Yajna. The third one is Daiva Yajna. It is not Deva Yajna, it is Daiva Yajna. And this is, Swami says, what we refer to as Swadhyaya. When you work on your own spiritual progress, when you take up self-study, when you read Vedanta, when you read Swami's message, when you read the scriptures of any religion for that matter, and you raise your own consciousness. This is a very, very important point, where Swami says that the moment you start raising your consciousness, the color of the actions that you perform change. Even though you're performing the same actions, even though your actions seem to be causing harm, even though your actions have not changed in nature, when your consciousness changes, the color of the actions changes. In fact, this is probably going to be the essence of what I wanted to convey, which I'm going to push it off to next week. It is about a very, very important concept of what is karma, what is vikarma, and what is akarma. The three things which Swami has spoken extensively about, it's there in the Bhagavad Gita. So, for now, the understanding that Daiva Yajna, which is when we raise our own consciousness, again, this is again a very beautiful point, when we take up to the study of scriptures, when we start reading Vedanta, when we start going deep into any spiritual text, we are doing it for our own benefit. We think that I am progressing spiritually. But Swami says this is also a form of yajna, because when an individual raises one's consciousness in an unconscious way, without his own knowledge, he is going to be benefiting people around him. So the third yajna which one performs as a remedy for the unconscious errors that one does in society is Daiva Yajna. The fourth one is Bhuta Yajna. Well, this is something which probably we can relate to more clearly. The bhutas are what the scriptures refer to as lesser beings. It's not about humans, those beings which are lesser than humans, which means all the other creatures. So Swami says that serving animals, birds, and other creatures, insects, in some form, this constitutes Bhuta Yajna. Well, this again, Swami says, is something which is so very beautifully, intricately intertwined into our rituals. And this is something which Swami will often quote, the act of drawing a rangoli, or what we call a kolam, in front of your house. Swami would say that you do it with rice flour. Of course, you do it for beautifying your house. You feel that it is a way of welcoming people who come to your house. But it is done with rice flour, and it is a process by which you feed the ants. So similarly, they would say that, you know, you feed stray animals. There are many rituals in the Sanatana Dharma tradition, which includes going to a goshala and feeding cattle there. And when Bhuta Yajna, I would say that it is not necessarily confined only to taking care of pets. Right? Yes, if you have pets, dogs, cats, you're taking care of them. I mean, that's really good. But Bhuta Yajna is about you going out of your way and being of service to some of these animals which probably will not benefit otherwise. In fact, for the matter, putting grains for birds, keeping water for birds outside, all of this, Swami says that it's a tradition which probably is dying out in cities, but in some form, if we can revive it. In fact, in one of the answers which I had spoken about, I was quoting another discourse where Swami speaks about how one should use one's earnings. When one leaves behind money for children, how it should be parted. where Swami was saying that one quarter should go for charity. In fact, one quarter in that, Swami says, should go for the use of animals and birds. So that is how important this is, this yajna of serving other beings, which benefit. That's what Swami says, that when you have a family set up, when you have a household, there are other beings which benefit from it. The stray animals around benefit, the ants benefit, the other small insects benefit from it, the birds and other beasts benefit from it. So the fourth one is called Bhuta Yajna, by which you feed some of these animals, insects and birds. The fifth one is what Swami refers to as Atithi Yajna. And Atithi, as we all know, is guests. We have the famous Vedic statement, Atithi Devo Bhava, consider your guests as God. So Atithi Yajna is nothing but taking care of the guests that come to your house, giving them water, giving them buttermilk, giving them something to eat. I mean, that used to be a tradition in all our families, right? Anybody walks into the house cannot leave without having something. So that is made so much intrinsic, made an intrinsic part of our culture, where you have to treat anybody who walks into your house as a guest. Of course, in the past, this used to be talked of as a very important role that a householder plays in the society. As I said, the sannyasis, the monks, the people who have become renunciants, they depend on householders for this. They are given this freedom of not to worry about their food. They are allowed and they're given this freedom to dwell on their spiritual life, because they can depend for their food and for their clothing and for their stay. They can turn to the householder for that. So that is why the atithi, taking care and showing hospitality to the people who come to your house, becomes a very important part of a householder. Yeah, I think most of us do that to only our own relatives and family, but Swami says that even that, this keeping this tradition of offering something to eat, to drink, to anybody who comes to our house, for that matter, it may not necessarily be the person who comes to your house as a guest. It could be the person who comes to your door as a courier man, who comes to your house as a person who has come to offer some service, an electrician, a plumber. You can even treat those people as atithis, as guests, and the compassion and the kindness that you show towards them would probably constitute in what Swami refers to as Atithi Yajna. Right? So quickly telling, what are those five yajnas which Swami spoke about? Swami spoke about Deva Yajna, which is when we sing out bhajans, devotional songs, when we chant the Vedas aloud, when we participate in Nagar Sankirtan, we help divinize the atmosphere around us. That is a form of yajna. Pitru Yajna, taking care of the elders in our families, our parents, our grandparents, and honoring them through our actions and through our obedience. That is the second form of yajna. The third is Daiva Yajna, where we study the scriptures to raise our own consciousness. And in just by doing that, you're actually doing a service to people around you. That's the third one. Bhuta Yajna, you being of service to other beings, bees, birds, insects. And we spoke about the various other traditional forms which are involved, which are used in the process to satisfy this Bhuta Yajna. And the fifth one is Atithi Yajna, where you take care of the people who come to your house. In whatever form, you treat them as guests and treat them as God, and you offer hospitality to them. And in general, Swami says that all of this, I mean, as you would see, all the five yajnas which I spoke about is not something which we have to go out of our way and doing. It's part and parcel of our lives. So Swami says all of these five yajnas have to be based on normal dharmic life. When a householder leads a normal dharmic life, earns his money through dharmic ways and spends it in a dharmic way, and in the process he or she will be performing these five yajnas, and that is more than enough to atone for the unconscious errors that one does. And this particular is taken from a discourse which Swami delivered in Hyderabad on the 20th of May 1984, if you're interested to read up that. Swami speaks about that. So that actually explains that apart from the consciously we using insect repellents and causing harm to these insects, there are so many things which happen unconsciously. And the point that we have to take is, yes, it does add a certain amount of karma to us, in even though we are doing it unconsciously. Is there a difference between doing karma consciously and unconsciously? And what is that difference? What consequence does doing an act consciously bring? And does that give us a hint of how karma should be performed? Excuse me. I think these are the questions which we have to dwell into, and I feel if we do this, we spoke about inevitable karmas in the sense of our existence. When we have to live in a society, we can't help but do certain karmas and how that affects us. We spoke of that. But there are some other karmas which get attached to the roles that we have to play in life. Being a mother, being a wife, being a husband, being a student, being a teacher. These are roles, these are dharmas. When karma becomes inevitable because of the dharma which one has to perform, what about the consequence of those karmas? I think that discussion will lead us on to the second question which was asked about when do you know it is right to point out somebody's error? Because that invariably means hurting the other person. When you criticize another person, especially within the setup of a family, it means hurting another person. When is it right to perform that karma? How should that karma be performed? That can be understood. And the hint for that comes from this idea that even unconscious karma leads to consequence, but conscious karma is something which leads to more consequences. So having this as a hint, how can we learn to deal with that? So that is actually the topic of which is going to lead us to the next question. As I said, Swami speaks about karma, akarma and vikarma, a concept which is there in the Bhagavad Gita. Probably we'll start with that next week, leading on to the answer for the second question. I hope, Sister Saraswati, that you could relate to the answer I gave for the first part of your question. Do tune in next week for the continuation. In the meanwhile, if you have any clarification about what I said, you can feel free to write to me. I'll probably add that to the answer of next week. I'll probably end with this. I know it's been a long answer, but I think it's a very important point. All of us can relate to this question. So on behalf of all of you, I thank Sister Saraswati for raising this question for discussion on Radio Sai Answering Booth. So with that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this show. It's been a bit late, but we started a bit late, so I guess it's all right. If you have any question on practical spirituality or some of the practical issues that you're facing and you're wondering what is a spiritual understanding of that problem, feel free to write to me. You can write in to prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. So the mails that you send to this mail ID will be read by me alone. So confidentiality is guaranteed. If you want to be anonymous, do let me know in your mail. I will not mention your name. It would be wonderful if you can send me your question in your own voice, like Sister Saraswati did. It would be wonderful to play it in your own voice and then answer the question. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. Once again, a very, very happy Navratri to all of you. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful Telugu song which sings and praises Swami as the mother. The meaning of the first few lines of this beautiful Telugu song means, which other mother will have so much love? And that's how the song describes Swami. I'm going to leave you with that song. On the other side of the song, you will have the program by Raghu on the Ashtotram. A little after 12:30, I will join you with Arvind for this week's afternoon satsang. But I'll join you again 11 a.m. for the continuation of the second part of the question which was asked today on Radio Sai Answering Booth.
సాయి మాతకు కాక జీవుల పైనా